I had another mission where I strap hanged with a guy named Hill. It was his team. He lost a man on his previous mission, and they were short-handed. So I went over, you know, Sergeant Downey asked me if I'd run with him, and I said, yeah, I'd be glad to. So I went over, talked to him, and I said, I hear you got a mission coming up. And he goes, yeah. I said, I hear you're down a man. He goes, yeah. I guess I'll run with you. And he goes, really? I says, yeah, awesome. So I said, what's the mission? Oh, they want us to go knock out a tank. And I'm going, what? I said, that tank's going to have thousands of people around it. Yeah, you don't want to get hit with like 1,000 men. Yeah, that's no fun.
Welcome to Heroes Behind Headlines. I'm your host, Ralph Bazzullo. Our guest today is Jim H. Shorten Jones, a.k.a. Wild Carrot, one of the heroes of the Secret War in Vietnam. Jim's story sounds like the plot of a superhero movie, but it's not. It's all true. Growing up in Liverpool, England, his family moved to the U.S. when he was a kid. At 15, Jim ran away and later joined the U.S. Navy and served in Vietnam. After completing his service in the Navy, Jim joined U.S. Army Special Forces in 1968 at the height of the Vietnam War. There, he ran Special Forces outposts and later volunteered for the highly dangerous Military Assistance Command Vietnam Studies and Observations Group, a.k.a. MACV-SOG, a multi-service elite military unit of the Vietnam War, so secret that its existence was denied by the U.S. government. Following more than a year with SOG, during which he served as the 1-0 or team leader of Recon Team Delaware and went on one harrowing mission after another, Jim sought more service and adventure. After completing Air Force pararescue training, he became an Air Force PJ. Among his accomplishments with Air Force pararescue are two amazing rescues at sea: rescuing survivors of the Mount St. Helens volcano eruption and serving as a parachuting paramedic for the first three launches of the space shuttle. After 20 years of service in the military, Jim decided to change directions and go to college to become a doctor in radiology. It's my great honor to welcome the extraordinary Jim Shorten Jones as today's hero behind the headlines.
Heroes Behind Headlines with Ralph Bazzullo.
Let's just jump right in because you've got an amazing story here and it's got several different parts to it. But let's start out with your background. Where were you born and how did you join the military?
I was born in Liverpool, England. And, you know, my mother was a donut dolly during the Second World War. And she met my father, who is a Royal Navy, British Royal Navy sailor. And he got hurt. And so he was in the hospital. And that's where they met. So then they ended up, after a few years, got divorced. And then when I came, I was in England. And so then we came back to the United States. And during that time, I was, my name was Shorten back when I was a kid. And that was my father's name. And so they got remarried and I was adopted in the name of Jones. Mm-hmm. So my name in the military all the way through was Jim Jones.
Okay.
So that's why you see a lot of my stuff has Jim Jones Shorten.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't get along with my stepfather very well. So I ran away from home when I was about 15 years old. I quit high school. When I was 17, I joined the Navy. And then from the Navy, you know, I volunteered to, I had a bunch of, you know, different duty stations. My first duty station was in Arizona. That's where I picked up, I started flying airplanes and skydiving back then when I was 17. And then from there, I went to Norfolk, Virginia, did a cruise on a ship for a while. And then I came back and I volunteered to go to Vietnam. And then I spent 22 months in Da Nang, Vietnam, working with the Seabees, Cargo Handling Battalion, too.
Uh-huh.
And then when I left there, I picked up a working knowledge of the Vietnamese language when I was there. So when I came back to the States, I joined the Army and I went directly into Special Forces. I signed up just for Special Forces. And if I would have failed, they would have sent me any place else I wanted to go. So I went ahead and passed everything in Special Forces. I was the outstanding trainee of the cycle in advanced infantry training. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I was outstanding trainee of the cycle, and I got that award. And so then I went to, you know, jump school, which was a piece of cake. Then I went up to Fort Bragg, North Carolina, and then went through Special Forces Phase 1. My job, well, at first they sent me into communications. I had a hard time with that diddy dum dum diddy. And so from there, I told them, look, I worked with the Seabees. I'm good in math. Put me in engineers. So they didn't. That was a breeze for me. So I did all that, the demolitions and everything. And then I contacted Billy Alexander up in the Pentagon, you know, Mrs. A. And she got me orders to go back to Vietnam. So I was the only one in my class that went directly to Vietnam. I was the last one to get orders. Mm-hmm. A lot of the other, you know, probably half the class went ahead and went to cross training. Uh-huh. And then they went to Vietnam. Some of them went to Germany and stuff, you know, with the 10th group. But I went back to Vietnam. I worked on an A team for a while. It was the largest A team in the world. It had about 50 guys on it.
Wow.
And, there was a security for Nha Trang, where the headquarters of Special Forces was, 5th Group.
Right, which was a beautiful, beautiful place, right?
Yeah, it was really pretty. It was a beautiful place. Well, Vietnam is a beautiful country. It really is.
And what year was this, Jim?
When I went to Special Forces, let me see, I was in the Navy in 64 to 68. So I joined the Army in 68. And I think it was 69 is when I went to Vietnam, late in 69.
Okay.
Then all of 70, and then I came back in 71. But I went there for 18 months, stayed there until I got my discharge. Missed my flight home twice, but because I wanted to run the missions. So I was on the A-team for a while. And then from the A-team, they put me on an outpost. I liked it, so I stayed on the outpost. I was the only American on it. Every once in a while, they'll send other guys down, you know, so they can get used to getting shot at and what have you. But on that outpost, I turned away a ground attack. I got hit about every third day, at least every day and a half to 3 days I got hit.
Okay. And the outpost was mainly indigenous?
Yeah. I had 133 Vietnamese with me.
Okay.
And I was the only American. The reason they put one American on each outpost around that area, mine was the furthest one out. It was on the other side of the mountains from the train. Mm-hmm. And the reason they put one American on there is mainly to talk to the aircraft.
Okay.
You know, when you got American pilots flying overhead, the Vietnamese can't really talk to them, you know, and if they did, you probably couldn't understand them. So I did that, and then the team turned over to Regional Popular Forces when getting ready to strut down the 5th, mm-hmm. and they were pulling back a lot. So then I volunteered to go to CNC, and so I went to CCC up in Kantoum. My first mission, I was assistant team leader, and the second mission, I was a team leader, mm-hmm. and then I went on from there. Then they sent me down to the school, the B-53, which is Special Operations Training down there, mm-hmm. and I went down there as an instructor, and from, you know, I taught infill, exfill, POW snatches. I think that was it. Anyway, I taught all that stuff. And so then when I came back to the States, I joined underwater operations with the 12th Reserve Group. So I was under the whole team. We went down and went to combat diving school. Uh-huh. Except it wasn't called combat diving school back then. It was just regular, you know, underwater operations. So we did that. And then later on, they gave us our orders for a combat diver. And then from there, I was training Air Force pararescue guys on night vision devices and foreign weapons. So did that. And then I didn't know who these guys were.
Yeah.
You know, because they're such a small group. So then I went ahead. We weren't doing anything in Special Forces, you know, mainly just training and stuff. So I went ahead and went down to talk to the pararescue guys. And so I left the Army and went into Air Force pararescue. And they sent me to training from there. And then I stayed there until I retired in 84. But I got injured. I would have stayed in, but I got injured, and they took me off jump status. So I took the medical and went and got out.
You're the only person I've ever met who was in the Navy, Army, and Air Force.
And when I was in the Navy, I worked with the Marines. I used to fly with Marine Air Group 16 out of China Beach. I did that on my days off. And I was talking to one of the other guys, I said, you know, I've actually got decorations from all five branches, actually, you know. Uh-huh. I even got a decoration from the Coast Guard.
Wow.
When I was working as a PJ.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I never thought of that until it came up, you know.
So you're probably the only person in history that's happened to, I would imagine.
It's very possible, I suppose. I don't know. There are guys that have hit. There's quite a few guys that went through three branches.
Okay.
But a lot of them were, they started off in the reserves and then went active in another group. You know? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. A lot of guys in the Marines cross-trained and that sort of thing to different branches. Mm-hmm. So, but then back on the A-team, when I ran some of those missions there, those missions were pretty much just going out and scouting the area looking for bad guys.
Huh?
And had no problems with that. I took a lot of prisoners when I was on the A-team.
Uh-huh.
You know, I'd surprise them by surprise, and we set up ambushes, and you'd take the guys you want, you know, get rid of the rest.
Uh-huh.
And but I did that. I think I took, I keep saying 15, but no, it's, I think it was, I took 12 prisoners when I was on the A-502. Okay. And I took 3 prisoners when I was down at B-53 with SOG. But that was in country. It's not that hard to take prisoners in country in Vietnam. On the other side of the fence, it's a little rough.
Yeah.
But yeah, the missions were pretty much like that. We had a couple camps. One camp got overrun. I mean, it was pretty bad. I mean, I went in. I was a reaction team to it.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I went in there, you know, there was bodies, you know, blown apart all over the place. You know, it was just a mess. They got overrun, and there was only one American on that. And sadly, he was drinking that night, so he was falling asleep in the bar when they got overrun. He made it. He got out of there, and I think there was when I went in, there was a real small little outpost, but there was like 16 bodies laying around, and I think they got like about 7 or 8 of the CIDG guys. They were laying around too.
Uh-huh.
A bunch of guys in the wire. But we found out that there was a hospital up in the hills from there.
The Civilian Irregular Defense Group, or CIGD, was a military program developed by the CIA in 1961 to counter expanding Viet Cong influence in the central highlands of Vietnam. Its aim was to develop paramilitary units recruited from indigenous ethno-minority populations, including the Montagnards, Hmong, Bru, and others. The program was highly successful in pacifying and defending villages, and over time, CIGD units were incorporated into the South Vietnamese Army, and its members were given full status as citizens of South Vietnam.
And so I volunteered. I said, let me go up there and see if I can find that hospital.
This is a Viet Cong or North Vietnamese hospital?
Well, it's mixed, NVA with Viet Cong.
Okay.
Yeah, because an NVA would come down and they would work with Viet Cong like we went over and worked with CIDG.
Right.
They would do that kind of sort of a thing, you know, and they would work with them. They trained some of them as interns and, you know, maybe for minor bandaging and stuff for wounds and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So, but so anyway, I set up an ambush and there was like about 13 guys came through. So we took, I can't remember how many I took out of there, 5 or 6 guys. I think it was 2 NVA and 3 Viet Cong that we got. And we went ahead and found one was a nurse, and the others were like picking up supplies and stuff in town.
Mm-hmm.
And walking back up. So we got them, and we found out where the cave was, where they had the hospital and everything.
Uh-huh.
But I wanted to go in and hit it, but the CEO wouldn't let me.
Uh-huh.
He goes, no, you know, we're too close to turning over to Regional Popular Force. We don't want anybody else getting hurt. So we backed away from it.
But most of the hospital was underground.
Yeah, they're all underground.
Mm-hmm.
In Vietnam. Yeah, they're in cave complexes and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, and there was a lot of cave complexes over there.
Uh-huh. Did you ever go into any of them?
No, I did. I did on when I was in SOG, I did go into one that I thought was a village and it turned out to be a hospital.
Uh-huh.
But I can get to that one later.
Okay.
Yeah, we just knew that there was a lot of cave complexes because we'd have guys, you know, like Spooky or Spectre would come over and maybe firing down at the enemy. And then all of a sudden you see little green tracers going back up at it. And then, you know, then they'd fire again with, you know, with the miniguns.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden you see little tracers going up again. So we knew the guys were hiding in a cave and then coming back out and shooting when the shooting stopped.
Yeah.
So wow. That was fun to watch that sort of thing, you know. But yeah. So, yeah, we never did go into that one hospital where it was.
Mm-hmm.
But that was rough there where that outpost got overrun.
Mm-hmm.
And then on my outpost, they got intel that they were going to overrun this special forces camp down at down by this rubber tree plantation. And I had a rubber tree plantation right next to my camp. So Tom Cameron was he was on the Santé raid and he's one of the enlisted guys in charge. Tom Cameron was quite a guy. He was our team sergeant, he got the word. So he came down, spent the night with me. And we just sat there back to back. And he goes, you tell your people if they're not wearing a hat, we're going to kill them. So he made sure, I made sure all my guys wore hats when they came out. And but nothing happened. So he went ahead and went back to camp and stuff. And then I was there. And all of a sudden, I started getting all these mortars going off around my camp. So I went outside and with the H1 radio, which is a direct line, you can only get it like, it has to be in line of sight. So I got that, and I had my interpreter in there on the radio telling, hey, tell them we're getting hit. And so they tried to overrun my camp, but I had food gas and everything set up out there. So I started blowing everything.
Well, Jim, what is food gas?
Food gas is kind of like napalm, but it's in a 55-gallon drum, and you put a block of C4 under it.
Okay.
And you just blow the whole thing, and it just blows us like gel all over the place.
Oh,
and
it's in flames. Wow.
Yeah, but what I didn't know was that you have to change it every 3 months because the gas will actually seep out of that tank, and then it'll evaporate. Oh. But when I blew it, it just blew a big cloud of white smoke, and the whole cloud just lit up with the flame.
Wow.
And it scared them, so they turned around and left.
Wow. So very dramatic. Yeah.
When I went out the next day to run out to find the areas where the fire mortars were firing from three locations, I found shipping plugs for 60 mortars, 60 rounds.
Yeah.
So I don't know how many, you know, some of them don't have shipping plugs. So I don't know how many rounds they hit me with.
Yeah.
But it was over 60 mortars coming into my camp.
Wow.
So, but I had all my guns set up, my machine guns and A6 machine guns and all that junk.
Uh-huh.
You know, so I had everything set. I had a really good fortified camp. And I also had chain link fence around all my bunkers.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you got hit with an RPG, if it hits the bunker, it's going to blow the bunker up. But if it hits chain link fence, what happens is it goes off. The only thing that hits the bunker is the motor.
Yeah.
So I did all that too. So I had a pretty well fortified camp. In fact, Colonel Roth came out to my camp. He wanted to see my camp because he knew I got hit. I was trying to overrun me, and he wanted to see how I built the camp.
Yeah.
And so he came out and we talked, and he asked me what my rank was.
Yeah.
I told him I was a Spec 4, and he hit Tom Cameron. He goes, you know, you can't have Spec 4s out here. He says it's going to have to be a hard 5 or above.
Yeah.
So Colonel Roth told me, there's a promotion board next week. I want you there. So I go down to the promotion board, you know, the next week, this captain next door to at Mac V camp.
Yeah.
He went ahead. He was like 5 miles up the road. So he went ahead and let me borrow his uniform and everything. He just took off his bars and he shined his boots for me. So I go down and I go to the board and I'm the first one in, and they look at me and they go, we look here and we see that you're in the Navy. I go, yes, sir. He goes, what's the difference between a ship and a boat? And there is a difference, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is. You know, I just said, well, I said, sir, you can put a boat on a ship, but you can't put a ship on a boat.
Yeah.
And he goes, that makes sense. Okay, you can go.
Yeah.
So I left and I walk out and the guys are asking me, what'd they ask you? What'd they ask you? They asked me, what's the difference between a ship and a boat? And they're all freaking out now. They're asking Navy questions? Good Lord.
What the heck? What kind of promotion board is this? Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, about a month later, the scores came out. I got the highest score in country, and they promoted me in operations and intelligence, and I got my hard 5.
Oh, wow. Wow. Congratulations. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was kind of
funny.
And
so you were good at setting up camps because of your engineering experience, I imagine.
Yeah. Well, I mean, to me, it was more like common sense. You know, you don't want your bunker blown up, put some chain link fence. What I used to do is go out and I'd capture a lot of enemy weapons and stuff like that. And I'd take them to these RIMPs, you know, the rear echelon MFs, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I take them out there and I trade them. I trade them for batteries. I trade them for cement. I trade them for chain link fence. And I just, you know, just all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So see what they could penetrate and what they couldn't.
Yeah. So I built up the camp. I built up some berms. I didn't really train the guys too much, you know, go out and train with them because they've been there a lot longer than I have. So they were pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
But we used to go out and run patrols. You know, we take maybe 20 guys and go run patrols around the camp and stuff. And every once in a while, FAC would fly over and say, is there anything I could do for you? And I said, well, see if you can scare any wildlife down this way. And they'd scare like deer or pigs or something down. and they'd fire little rockets at him or something and chase him, and they'd come running down, and then we'd sit with our weapons and shoot him, and then we'd have a big barbecue.
And you could speak Vietnamese, so you could talk to the
I had working knowledge of Vietnamese, so and I had an interpreter. His name was Nua.
Yeah.
And Nua was actually Chinese.
Okay.
And but he spoke like seven languages.
Wow.
But he stuttered. He always wanted to be a jet pilot for the Vietnamese.
Yeah.
But he stuttered, and he couldn't he wouldn't let him be a pilot.
Okay. Okay. Wow.
It was funny, you know, like when you get in trouble and you tell him, hey, Nu, get on the radio and tell him we're getting hit. And he'd be stuttering.
Yeah.
And the fight would be over with it. I'd come back in and he's still stuttering.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
So, and I'd pick it up and say, now we got it under control.
And you talked somewhere, I heard you were talking about that you would go to certain bars and they would.
Yes.
Yeah. So tell that story.
On the mountain range that was between the Chang and my camp, there was a big mountain range there called Han.
Mm-hmm.
Or the Dongbo Mountains, I think it was. And we had a camp called the Han. We'd go looking around, and every once in a while we'd get in a firefight or something like that. Then we'd come on back down, and then on the other side where my camp was, the road goes north out of the Trang, goes around to the west, and then comes back down on the other side of the mountains and goes down to Cameron Bay.
Oh, okay.
And my camp was off to the west of that road.
Mm-hmm.
So we'd come on down to that road coming out of the mountains. And I remember one time we walked into a bar. We figured, you know, they're going to pick us up in trucks and haul us back to where we got to go. Some of the guys would go back to the main camp, and then I'd go back to Suyao, where my outpost was. So I'm coming down. We go into this bar, and we see them taking down the NVA flag, and they're putting up the Vietnamese flag, South Vietnam flag. And we'd look at him and go, what's going on, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And we'd sit there having a beer, and they said, well, the enemy was just here, and they left. And he says, when they come in, we put up a flag, and when you guys come, we put up your flag.
Wow.
You know, just so we don't get hit, which is okay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's how they survived.
It keeps them from getting killed by the enemy.
Did you ever have any occasion where you were, like, in town or something like that, and you saw the enemy or who you thought was the enemy?
Yeah, we had one where we went in, we got into a firefight. We were going to lay down. We were going to set up an ambush at night on this railroad track because we knew the enemy was using the railroad.
Mm-hmm.
So we were getting ready to lay down, and I was talking to Jim Roush, who was a former SOG runner out of CCS.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, he got hit. He got up here. He got hit on the side with a bullet. So he was recouping from that, and then so he came over to the A-team. And so we were out there. We had this little thing called the Phantom Team. There was four of us that set up, and we had some Vietnamese with us. And I'm standing there talking to Jim, and I'm going, what are they putting claymores out? You know, like we put claymores out?
Yeah.
Put them out. And I go, whoa, those are bad guys.
Yeah.
He goes, where? And so I put a magazine. Don't ever do this.
Yeah.
I put magazine or tracers in, and I fired at the enemy. Well, all I did was mark my own location, and they all started shooting at me. I had a bullet hit right in front of me. It hit something on the ground, came up, hit me in the face, and knocked me for a loop.
Wow.
So I go, man, I fell down. And I go, I'm hit like that. And so Jim comes over with a little red flash because the firefight lasted about 20 seconds.
Yeah.
He goes ahead and he puts his flashlight on me, you know, a little red light. And he goes, oh, you're going to be okay. I go, what is it? He goes, I don't know, but you're going to have one heck of a shiner. But I had the big old black eye. I think the bullet hit a piece of wood or something.
Okay. And it ricocheted.
And it came back up and hit me in the face because it was too big.
Yeah.
It covered like all around here.
Yeah.
All my nose and everything.
Yeah.
So it was too big.
Wow.
To just be the bullet itself.
Yeah.
But I did get, I did have some bone growth growing up in here.
Uh-huh.
And I had that removed
because
it was pushing out. I looked like I had little horns.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, so after that firefight, we asked for a resupply, and they said, no, just come on out. We're going to bring some trucks down and get you out of there. So we spent the night, and then we walked out the next morning. We stopped and went fishing, you know, with hand grenades, where you throw the grenades in the water, and then we'd all jump in the water and then grab all the fish and put them in a rucksack. So we had a rucksack full of fish.
So it's like fishing with dynamite. I've heard of that, but not with grenades.
Yeah.
Yeah, the percussion would knock the fish out.
So we went in the town. We traded all the fish for some beer.
Uh-huh.
And we're sitting in this little restaurant and having, you know, like a little bowl of rice and some beer and stuff. And I look over and I see these tall guys in black pajamas, you know. And I see them walking out and they're white, really white.
Yeah.
You know, because they don't get, they work at night. They don't work during the day, so they don't get much sun.
Yeah.
And I looked at Jim and I go, do you see what I see?
Yeah.
He goes, yeah. He goes, that's the enemy.
Yeah.
I go, yeah. So But the big Chinese guys, they just sit, gave us a dirty look and they walked out. Huh. And I think it was about 5 or 6 days later, they were killed on an ambush.
Oh, wow. The same guys.
Yes, another team went out and they killed them on an ambush.
Wow. And they were Chinese.
Yeah, they were Chinese. They were probably, working with the NVA.
Yeah.
Yeah, I went out and they wanted me to go out and take pictures of their face. You know, when they're laying there, I took pictures of them because we put them in a folder and for intel and stuff.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And one of them, one of the sisters was there and of the people. And I said, I'm sorry, but I've got to take pictures. And because they had covers over their face. So I took the covers off, took the picture. And she goes, well, he chose to work with the enemy.
Oh, wow.
That kind of thing. So.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. So she was pretty much like her freedom. And this other guy wanted to work with North Vietnam. So that's what happened there.
Wow.
So, but but you get a lot of those little kind of missions like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I picked up a guy one time. One of the other guys, I captured him. He got shot in the leg in an ambush and they left him there. The NVA left him there.
Mm-hmm.
And took him. He's a 14-year-old kid.
Wow!
So I grabbed him and had him bring him back to my camp, and got him there. And I was treating him. I gave him some morphine. And when I was giving him morphine for his pain, he was like a 14-year-old kid. I was giving him morphine, and he was terrified.
Yeah,
and he was mumbling, and I had a hard time understanding him. But my interpreter said that he goes, he thinks you're going to kill him.
Yeah,
and eat him.
Oh my God!
And I told him, I said, no. I said, come. You know, I said, I'm not going to eat you.
Yeah.
You might be a juicy little tender morsel since you're 14 years old, but no, I'm not going to eat you.
Yeah. Oh my God.
So, but then I took him down to the hospital, and I had it out with the docs down there. I he ended up losing his leg. I went down to visit him, and then I went down again, and he was gone. I said, what happened to him? He goes, he died. And I'm going, he only got shot in the leg.
Yeah.
You know, he got shot in the femur. He had a broken leg.
Yeah.
And which is extremely painful.
Yeah.
You know, because your leg muscles are so strong. So the doc, he goes, well, you know how many Americans I see dying because of people like him? I said, he's a 14-year-old kid doing what his government's telling him to do. He doesn't know you from Adam. I says, you just killed our intelligence because he could have told us a lot of information.
Yeah.
You know, if you just treat him right. He was at 14. He wasn't no hardcore. Right.
This was an American doctor or a Vietnamese doctor?
American doctor.
Wow.
Yeah. So I almost got in a fight when the nurses broke us up and I left. I just told the doctor, I said, you have an oath. You know what? And he says, you can live with it. He was a 14-year-old kid.
Wow. That's ugly. Yeah.
Yeah. It's really sad. I mean, I don't have a big heart for the enemy, of course.
Yeah, but they're human beings. Yeah. And as you say, he could have been a good intelligence source.
Yeah, very good intelligence source.
Had you treated them well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, we used a lot of them.
Yeah.
You know, the strata teams that we used in SOG, you know, they were a different outfit in SOG. Those strata teams were all NVA that we picked up and we brought them over to our side. And then we dress them back up in their old clothes, put them back out in the field. And they would go in and take pictures up by the, you know, Burma or Chinese border, trying to get pictures of trucks, see if there's any Americans going to China, that kind of thing, pilots and stuff.
Yeah.
They used to do that sort of thing. That's a strata team.
Strata teams? What were strata teams, Jim?
That's what they were. They were NVA teams that worked on our side, and then they'd put them back in again. And they would go out with cameras and try to take pictures and stuff like that, trying not to get caught.
And they'd go out on their own?
Yeah, they'd send them out like maybe a 3 or 4-man team, 6-man team.
Wow.
I don't know too much about strata because it was highly classified. So I really don't know a whole bunch about it.
Yeah. I never heard of it before. Yeah.
Yeah. I interviewed one guy one time that was strata. He's the only guy left.
Uh-huh.
Because sadly, I won't get into it, but he was the only guy that lived.
Uh-huh.
So, but, and a lot of the SOG guys liked him.
Yeah.
You know, and I think it was up by CCN where they're running out of. Yeah. But he was really a cool guy.
Yeah. So. Wow. Interesting. MACV SOG headquarters was located in the capital of South Vietnam, Saigon. Initially, there was one command and control, or CNC element, in Da Nang with 6 forward operating bases, FOB-1 at Phu Bai, FOB-2 at Con Tum, FOB-3 at Khe San, FOB4 at Da Nang, FOB5 at Banh Mi Phut, and FOB6 at Ho Nuc Tao. Later, in 1969, FOBs 1, 2, and 6 were redesignated Command and Control North, or CCN. FOB2 became Command and Control Central, CCC, and it was located in Kontoon in the Central Highlands near the border with Cambodia and Laos. And FOB5 was renamed Command and Control South, CCS, with headquarters in Banh Mi Phut.
I volunteered for CNC and they sent me to CCC up in Kontoon, Command and Control Central.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I got there, they put me on a team with Dan Sturt. Dan was the 1-0 of RT Delaware.
Mm-hmm.
And so we went and ran a mission, and then Dan didn't want to run anymore. So he, after that mission, Dan left the team, and he had a lot of missions, though. He had a lot. He went through a lot. So it was time for him. You know, when you're ready to stop running, it's time to stop running.
Yeah. And they would let people decide. It was all voluntarily.
Oh, yeah. Strictly volunteer.
Yeah.
Nobody said you do this.
Yeah.
You know, no, that was something you strictly volunteered for SOG.
Okay.
Yeah, because it was highly classified.
When you say, I'm done, I can't do anymore, they honor that.
Yes.
Yeah.
No matter how, they ask is if you can run 3 missions, that's good.
Yeah.
You know, we're happy if you can at least run, because they're putting a lot of training on you.
Right.
Because you go to 1-0 school and they're putting a lot of money into you.
Yeah. And the 1-0 is the leader of the team.
Yeah. 1-0 is a leader. 1-1 is the assistant team leader. 1-2 is usually the radio operator. 1-3, if you got one, is just a backup guy.
Yeah.
So usually some new guys that don't have much experience are coming from the States.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, on the second, as soon as we came back, they quit. And so I was running around, you know, and I stayed with Delaware. And then Sergeant Downey was our sergeant of recon.
Mm-hmm.
And then he came up to me and asked me, he says, how'd you like to take over Delaware? I only ran one mission. so he says, well, we think you're ready. Because I had a lot of missions and I had a lot of battle,
right.
You know, a lot of fighting and stuff with the enemy at the A-team.
Right.
So I said, well, I'll give it a shot.
Yeah.
So I became the 1-0.
And that was very, I would imagine that's really unusual for somebody to.
Yeah, it is unusual. Because there's a lot of guys that's had like 6-7 missions, 10 missions, and never became 1-0s.
Yeah.
Some people didn't want the responsibility.
Yeah.
You know, and I felt like that too. I said, that's a heck of a lot of responsibility.
Yeah.
You got all these lives in your hand.
Yeah.
But the one thing I did is I knew how to call in helicopters. I knew how to call in fire, firefights on top, you know, the warbirds and stuff. I knew how to talk to everybody.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I knew my tactics. And so, and I was very calm in battle. I was pretty calm.
Uh-huh. What was your team made up of?
Montagnards.
All Montagnards.
And I had about 10 Montagnards on the team.
Uh-huh.
But I only took five of the guys with me.
Okay.
When I went on a mission.
Yeah.
And some of the guys would stay back and then get the other five.
Right.
I had an interpreter that spoke English and Montagnard.
Uh-huh.
And so he was Montagnard. So, but I had another guy that was, he spoke Vietnamese, Montagnard, and English.
Oh, wow.
And so I was able to talk with him. So I would use him as an interpreter for if I had my other guy stay back.
Yeah.
His name was Toli. I guess I can mention his name, but he was killed in he escaped from those re-education camps.
Yeah. After the war.
He escaped three times. And on the third time they shot him and killed him.
Oh, wow. Wow.
And I found that out when I went back in 2002.
Uh-huh.
I was going up the Ho Chi Minh Trail and I hired this company that was cutting down trees.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to give him $400. I said, I'll give you $200 now, $200 when I come back.
Yeah.
And so they had a Vietnamese driver and the guy was actually at CCC.
Oh, no kidding. Wow.
Yeah. He was working in our dispensary.
Yeah.
And he told me what happened.
Oh,
you know,
wow.
Because he kind of asked me, he comes up to me and he goes, were you in Kontoon? And I said, yes. He goes, I worked at CCC. And I go, I was with CCC.
Yeah.
And he goes, please don't tell them anything.
Yeah.
You know, like that. Because he was afraid that they would harm him.
Sure.
He because, you know, even though the war's, they say, if you talk to Vietnamese, they say the war's over.
Yeah.
But it's not over for the South Vietnamese.
Yeah.
The South Vietnamese can't own a business. They can't buy a house. They can't do anything because they were South Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember one time I met some Vietnamese when I was in Cambodia, and they looked at me and they said, "Were you in Vietnam?" I go, "Yeah." He goes, "We won that war." And I looked at him. I said, "You stupid asshole." I said, "If you call losing 4 million people winning a war, you're an idiot."
Yeah, yeah.
He just looked at me with a dirty face and walked away.
Yeah.
So
they took it hard.
Oh, yeah. They lost a lot of people. We won that war.
Yeah.
And that last big push that the enemy was doing from North Vietnam, that was going to be their last push, and they were going to quit. But we had these idiots in our government here throwing the towel in, you know.
Yeah.
Well, you know, everybody wants us to get out of Vietnam. So if we get out of Vietnam, maybe we can win the next election.
Yeah.
A bunch of crap. Yeah, I came back from that first. Oh, that first mission. What happened is they were going to put it when I was with Dan Sturr. They were going to put us in outside of a regiment, a battalion. They wanted us to go through and gather intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
So they put what they did is they put us down in
a battalion of North Vietnamese.
North Vietnamese.
In Laos or in Cambodia?
It was in Laos.
Okay.
And what happened is those old French maps that they had that we were using were not very good. I mean, they had these big white blotches on them.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, you'd have, it was written in their clouds.
Ah.
Because they were making the maps from photographs.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they got confused where they were putting us in. And so they dropped us in right between them.
Oh, wow.
And so they let us get on the ground, and then they tried to capture us.
Mm-hmm.
And we got chased by dogs. We got chased by everything. I mean, I remember sitting on the side of a hill, you know, when you got a hill and you got a tree like this, straddle the tree. You know, we'd straddle the tree and just so we don't roll down the hill because it's steep.
Yeah.
And that's how we rested at night. And we get up in the morning where you can see these guys banging sticks and running through. You can see them down at the bottom there.
Yeah.
You know, and they're trying to chase us out like we're wild animals.
Wow. Wow.
You know, so, but that was really close. So we finally escaped and got out of there.
With King Bees, with South Vietnamese helicopters, or?
No, we used Hueys. CCC had more Hueys than the King Bees, but we did have King Bees as well.
Okay. So that was what, 101st Airborne?
I don't know who the Huey pilots were.
Mm-hmm.
They were Americans, though.
Okay.
Yeah, the King Bees were the Vietnamese, and I think it's the 119th or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they were at CCN. I don't know if that, I think ours were too.
Okay.
But these guys could actually, they could fly for 6 years and then they would let them retire out of the military and not fight anymore.
Yeah.
So, that was one of the things, but a lot of them just stayed there anyway and just kept flying with us until it was over.
Mm-hmm.
The King Bee pilots were awesome.
Yeah.
They were freaking awesome. They were fearless.
Yeah.
They would, you know, they didn't care. They just went on in.
So even though they were getting shot up, they'd come in and get you.
Oh, Hueys would too.
Yeah.
You know, but yeah, you know, it's, yeah, I've been in a few choppers. I've been shot up pretty good.
Yeah, I bet. I bet. Yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of a weird feeling, you know.
Yeah.
Because you feel so vulnerable. You're in the sky in this.
Yeah.
Cube flying around,
yeah,
and all of a sudden you hear this ting 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 where the bullets are slamming the side of the aircraft,
yeah,
you know, and but I can get that mission later.
Yeah, okay.
Anyway, so it took Dan blew an abatis on a tree. That's where you blow a tree and the tree goes over and it's still connected to the stump.
Mm-hmm.
And they did that for roads during the Second World War, so the jeeps couldn't go by. They'd have to cut the log to get the jeeps out. So they did it in areas where you couldn't go around the tree.
Yeah.
And so we blew the abatis, and then the chopper would come down the side of the hill and land next to it, and then, or not land, but hover next to the stump.
Yeah.
And then we'd run up the tree and get into the helicopter. You know, and that's how we did that to get out of there.
Wow.
And I was that since I was
being shot leader, at the whole time, probably.
No, on this one here, we didn't get shot at all.
Oh, good.
The chopper came in, got us. But on that one, you know, I had two Montagnards with me. They went ahead and got on, and then. Or three, I think I had three of them. They got on, and then I ran up and got on, and they were taking off, and I'm hanging on the strut. And I said, "Man, does anybody see me here?"
Right.
And so finally, the Montagnard's yelling at the gunner, saying, "Hey, look down, look down."
Yeah.
And so I look. He finally looks down. I see these big eyes looking at me.
Yeah.
And he's yelling, telling the pilot, he said, "We got a guy hanging on the strut." I'm like, 400 or 500 feet in the air, hanging on the strut. And finally, they reach way down, like one of the guys will lay on their legs.
Yeah.
And he reached way down, grabbed my arms, and they pulled, the gunner and one of the yards pulled me back up.
Wow.
So I can get on the strut and climb in.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. It was, I was pretty scary. I could have ended my life right there.
I bet. Yeah. For sure. For sure.
Then we had three Americans on that team. We had one guy, Gary Harned.
Mm-hmm.
Gary Harned was on that team. And then Gary, it was Gary's first mission. And on his second mission, he was running with RT Pennsylvania, and the whole team got wiped out.
Oh, God.
So it was really kind of tragic.
Yeah, yeah.
And Dan left, and he went to work for the over in the club. And then I had to, I became the 1-0 of the team, and then I was looking for somebody to go with me. And so I met this guy, Homer Hungerford. And Homer was an older guy, and a lot of guys didn't want to run with him, mm-hmm. you know. But he was good.
Yeah.
I mean, he was in World War II and Korea War and then Vietnam.
So a lot of experience.
So we had a lot of combat.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so I knew he wasn't going to freeze. He wasn't going to freeze in a firefight.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, because he's like a triple CIB-er.
Yeah.
So combat infantry brat, for those that don't know what that is.
Yeah.
So he was a good man.
Uh-huh.
And Homer passed away in 2014.
Oh.
But just really a good guy.
And that was a problem? Some guys would just go out and they couldn't handle it, right? Because it was so intense.
Oh, yeah. There are some teams that go out, and when you get into a heavy fight, like bullets are flying all around,
yeah,
they'll freeze.
Yeah.
They'll freeze. It's, you know, like on the one with Lynn Black, you know, they had a guy that he just watched the guy in front of him get killed, and he just hit the ground, and he was just sitting there praying to God and curled up in a little ball.
Yeah.
And they got him out. When he got out of there, he was out of SOG.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's some guys, even guys that were experienced in battles in the 101st and stuff like that. You know, battles had a year of combat.
Mm-hmm.
They go into SOG, they run a mission, and it's like, whoa, this is too heavy for me. I don't want this.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, because we lost 50% of our men. 50% of us were killed.
Wow.
You know, and we were all wounded.
Yeah.
One or more times.
Yeah.
You know.
And it was constant, right? You were just running one mission after the other.
Yeah, usually some guys would run more missions than others.
Mm-hmm.
When I was on the A team, I ran missions back to back to back. You know,
mm-hmm.
I just come in, get more food, throw up my pack, and go back out.
Uh-huh.
I'll tell you another story on that.
Yeah,
on Mondays, it was my day off. So I left Su Yao, my outpost, and I'd come back up the main camp. And I would say, I'd just go up the main camp, and then I'd drive a Jeep and go downtown. I'd park it at the headquarters, take a jitney downtown.
Mm-hmm.
And meet up with a girlfriend, because I had girlfriends and stuff over there.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I'm going into the camp, and they're playing a football game.
Yeah.
And we had a major in charge of our A team. Most only have captains, but we had so many guys, 50 guys, so we had a major in charge.
Yeah.
Major John McBride.
Mm-hmm.
And so, the major looks at me, and I'm glad you're here, Jones. He goes, kind of, you can play on this other team. I go, no, I don't play football. I was a gymnast in high school.
Right.
I said, I don't play football.
Yeah, yeah.
And he goes, well, we want you to play now, so get over there. I go, I'm not going to play football. This is my day off. I'm going downtown to get laid or something. and so he goes, well, you got a choice. You either play football, or you can go out in the field and replace Gigliani and what was the other guy's name? I can't think, Purdue or something. I can't remember his name. Anyway, so I says, well, let me put some food in a ruck. Just get on a helicopter. So they call in a helicopter. I get on a helicopter. They fly me out in the field at Funk. It was George Funk and Gigliani. I think it was Dave Gigliani. But they were two big guys and loved playing football.
Yeah.
So they would give me their rucksack, and I had my rifle and stuff. And I would just take their rucksack. They'd go back and play football, and I'd continue the mission.
Wow. So it was either play football or run a mission.
Yeah, exactly.
And you chose to run the mission.
I chose to run the mission. I don't want to play football. And that's not if it was soccer, it'd be a little different. I like soccer. I'm from England. What can I say?
Right, right, right. What the hell's football?
And that's one of the, I was raised in the mountains when I came over to this country. I lived in Colorado up in the mountains, and that's where I got a lot of my stealth and stuff working, trying to look for animals.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I didn't know anything about baseball, football, anything. I tried playing baseball. I just couldn't pick it up.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I got into high school, I was a gymnast.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
P-bars, rings, and ropes. They had ropes back then. They don't have them anymore.
Yeah, ropes were tough, man. I tried those. Really tough.
Yeah, ropes. I mean, you powder up your hands, and yeah. You got to go up and hit the chalk on the top of that thing they have on the top of the rope. It's like a 20-foot rope or something. I can't remember.
Yeah.
But I was pretty good at it.
Wow.
Yeah, you don't use your legs. You just use your arms.
Yeah, yeah. You have to be tremendously strong in your arms and shoulders. Yeah.
Yeah, I was pretty strong when I was, I lifted weights for a year and then went into gymnastics, and I did 200 push-ups, 200 sit-ups, 200 jumping jacks every morning.
Wow.
I did that all the way through the Navy and did it quite a ways through the Army as well.
Uh-huh.
And then when I got in the Air Force, PJs,
That's rough.
Yeah, you do a lot of push-ups. I was watching a vlog just last night where this guy, he says, yeah, when I was a PJ, they dropped me for 1,000 push-ups.
Whoa.
So I'm going, oh, I got dropped for 1,500 push-ups one time.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
So let's go back to SOG.
So after that mission and everything, I went ahead and I got Homer. I ran probably more bright light missions than I ran just like linear recons. I think I only ran like 2 linear recons and 2 road watches.
Okay.
But I had 3 bright lights.
And can you explain what a bright light is?
Bright light is the most dangerous mission. That's where there's a team in trouble or a pilot's down or there's a body and mm-hmm. You're going right into the battle to get him out.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll fly right into a bullets flying all over the place. And you just get right on the ground and, and get the body and try to get out of there as fast as you can.
Yeah.
And when I was on my team, was down and Downey, Sergeant Downey, our recon guy, he came over and he goes, hey, Jim, he says, your team's down right now. I says, yeah, we had those missions and I told him to take the week off.
Yeah.
He goes, well, how would you like to go up to Dock Tow for a bright light stand down with RT Illinois?
Yeah.
And I said, well, let me go talk to the team. And so I talked to the team and their 1-0 was on a 30-day leave.
Mm-hmm.
It was Steve Keever.
Mm-hmm.
And so I told him, I says, yeah, I'll take him. So we went up there on the bright lights up at Dock Tow because it was closer to Laos and Cambodia by tri-border.
Mm-hmm.
Then we were up there. We got a mission. So the choppers were coming in. And when they were coming in, Steve Keever gets off the chopper. And he wanted to see how our team was doing. He heard they were up there. I go, hey, Steve, what are you doing here? He goes, I just thought I'd come up and say hi. He says, I just got back from leave.
Yeah.
I says, well, we're going on a bright light. You want to go? And what's he going to do? He can't say no. It's his team,
Yeah, yeah.
He goes, sure, I'll go. What's the mission? A guy was killed coming out on strings. It's a stable rig, the ropes.
Yeah.
He was killed coming out. The rope got either caught a bullet or something, but the rope broke and he fell to his death. He, I don't know, like 300-400 feet, something like that. So I asked Steve, want to take over? And he goes, no. He says, you've already been briefed. You just take the team and mm-hmm. I'll just go as the 1-1. Mm-hmm. And his 1-1-1 is the 1-2.
Yeah.
So I said, it's only going to be the 3 of us. Now his little brain is going, you're going to do what?
Just three people, 3 Americans.
Yeah, I said, we don't have time for 2 helicopters. There's going to be a ton of guys that are coming after us.
Yeah.
So it says they're estimating around 350 enemy.
Wow.
Because that's the team that was getting pulled out.
Yeah.
That's what they got hit with.
Yeah.
And so they had a guy killed, I think, or whatever. I can't remember the whole thing on that team. I can't even remember what team it was.
Yeah.
But they brought him out. And this one guy was killed on the ropes.
Yeah.
And so one of the Cobra gunships saw the rope hanging in a tree.
Uh-huh.
And so I guess it whipped around a branch or something, didn't go all the way to the ground, follow him down to the ground.
Right.
So, but I told him, says, we don't have time. It says, we're just going to go rappel in as close as we can get to this guy, grab him, have him drop the rope, because there's 4 ropes.
Yeah.
So drop the ropes and we'll put the body on one. The 3 of us will hook up and we just get back out of there and get back here.
Yeah.
Okay. I said, that sounds good on paper.
Yeah, yeah.
So we did. We went in, rappelled in. And then when we got in there, we couldn't get all the way to the ground because it was like triple canopy.
Yeah.
And the ropes wouldn't reach the ground.
Oh, wow.
So we're coming down. So the chopper just starts coming down, just starting mowing down the vegetation.
Yeah.
So we could get on the ground. So we got off. The Cobra flies over and he goes, my code name was the Wild Carrot.
Uh-huh.
So he goes, Carrot, follow me.
Yeah.
So I started walking up the hill because he saw the rope. And then when I got up there, about 100 meters, I got up there and I saw the rope.
Yeah.
So we went ahead and we dug the guy up and then had the chopper come over.
So you found the body?
Yeah, we found the body.
Yeah.
And so the chopper came on over and dropped the ropes and stuff. They're the same ropes we rappelled in on.
Yeah.
And And so then they we hooked up him. I hooked up the body and they hooked me up. I hooked them up and I said, get us out of here. And as they're picking us up, we can hear the enemy coming. They're screaming and yelling.
Yeah.
You know, come on, let's go. We got to go faster, faster. And you can hear them yelling at us.
Yeah.
So they're coming up the hill. And so as we're getting up through the trees, as soon as I get above like the second canopy, I can look down and I can see down through the trees. I can see them coming.
Yeah.
And they're sitting there shooting at the helicopter and trying to shoot at us too. But they're mainly wanting to get the, if they shoot the helicopter down, then they got us all.
Yeah, right.
So we're coming up and we finally get up and we're still shooting at them and stuff. And so we get up and we're flying away on the end of the strings. And this A-Mini Sky Raider comes right down underneath me. Just comes right underneath me, like 50 feet away.
Whoa.
And he just looks at me and he just waves like that, you know? And so I'm holding on to this dead guy and I'm going, hey,
you know? Wow, that's crazy.
But yeah, it was like when we were shooting and you can hear the bullets whizzing by us, you know?
Yeah.
They were cracking because, you know, it loses the sound barrier. They slow down when you're shooting up.
Mm-hmm.
So, but anyway, we're coming out and stuff and I'm holding on to this guy. He's going, dear God, get us out of here, you know?
Yeah.
They finally got us out of there. We came back. It was a good mission.
Wow.
None of us got hurt. The chopper had a few holes in
I
it.
I bet it did.
We're fine.
Thank God for that chopper pilot, man.
Yeah, he was a good guy. when we got back to Dock Tow, all the skin on the bottom of the Huey,
yeah,
on the rotor.
Yeah.
All the skin was gone.
Wow.
On the bottom of the rotor.
Wow.
From chopping down through the bushes.
I bet. Yeah, they're not made for that.
No. I don't know. I can't remember if they're balsa wood wings. I think Pedro had balsa wood wings, rotors. I'm not sure. I know one of them had balsa wood.
Yeah, they're very light, whatever they are.
Yeah, they're very light.
Yeah.
And strong.
Yeah. Wow.
So then after that mission, let me see. I think we had another mission. We had the Cobra 8-4 mission. But before I get into that one, I'll get into something like the Road Watch missions. When you're on a road watch mission, you go on down, you usually stay away from the road during the day.
Mm-hmm.
And towards the evening, you start moving down towards the road because they have enemy on the road.
Yeah. And this is the Ho Chi Minh Trail.
Ho Chi Minh Trail.
Yeah.
And what they're doing is they have these guys, like two or three guys walking up down the trail.
Mm-hmm.
And they would shoot signal shots if it's clear.
Yeah.
And then the trucks would start coming through.
Mm-hmm.
Or not clear.
Mm-hmm.
And heck, I remember one time when the enemy started shooting each other on the road.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because we dress up like the enemy a lot of times.
Ah.
So they would think that they were shooting at us and they're shooting at their own people.
Okay.
Yeah, I've seen that happen a couple of times.
Wow.
Up there.
Wow. That must be interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, they're under a lot of stress. You gotta remember, North Vietnamese lost a lot of people.
Yeah.
So they're fighting with girls and women and and young kids.
Yeah.
You know, and they're terrified.
Yeah.
You know. You jump out of the bushes to grab these guys, and they go, ah! You know, they're terrified. Yeah, so
they would run the trucks mainly at night.
Yeah, they ran the trucks at night. I think one time on one road watch, we counted 7 trucks coming down. And what we try to do is we try to do it during a full moon,
mm-hmm.
where you can actually try to see what's in the trucks.
Yeah.
You know, if it's like weapons or food or supplies and stuff like that, you know,
mm-hmm.
Soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
So you look for that sort of thing. And one time we counted 7 trucks. Another time we counted 14.
Hmm.
And then in the morning at like 7 in the morning, they'll fly over. I think it's 7 in the morning, 5 o'clock at night. About 7 in the morning, the FAC would fly over. But he doesn't fly over you. He flies off to the side.
Yeah.
And then we'll give them a sit rep, how many trucks and what we saw and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And they take that information, send it to Saigon, and they work with it from there.
Mm-hmm.
But as soon as the FAC leaves, the enemy will mortar that whole area.
Yeah, yeah. So that's why you want them flying over there, not over you.
Yeah, they don't fly overhead.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's smart.
So we did those in linear recons. That's just going from point A to point B, and you're trying to see what's in there, if there's any enemy,
mm-hmm.
because they might think there might be some people going through. We want to see if you can find them.
Mm-hmm.
I remember one time I was strap hanging on another team. We were doing a linear recon, and Joe Vandar was the 1-0 on it. And so we were walking through, and then we started noticing we were walking in a circle because we saw our own tracks, but then we started seeing the enemy's tracks on top of ours.
Mm.
So we went back and we stopped at a spot in the brush to take a break. And all of a sudden, the enemy walked right by us. They were like,
wow.
They were like 3 feet away, 3-4 feet away.
Wow.
They just walked right by.
Yeah.
And I thought they were going to hear my heart beating.
Yeah. So they'd been tracking you.
They were tracking it. And there was a tree. There was a high-speed trail right there.
Yeah.
We didn't see it because of the foliage.
Yeah.
You know, all the plants. They couldn't see us. I could see them.
Yeah.
Because I was laying down as close as I could to the ground and looking off to the side. I could see their legs walking by me.
Wow.
Then I was thinking on jumping up and grabbing them. And Joe Vandiver said, no.
Yeah.
He goes, no, we don't know who's behind him.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Probably good advice.
Well, I would have taken him anyway and just battled it out, you know. and if you have to, you can have them drop ropes. They'll drop the ropes. You can just throw the guy in a Hanson rig and just have him hoist up and get him out of there.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and then you can just move on and.
Yeah.
And just go do your thing.
Yeah.
You know, you can get away from them, hopefully, unless they come at you with like. Yeah, you don't want to get hit with like 1,000 men.
No.
That's no fun.
Yeah.
I had another mission where I strap hanged with a guy named Hill. It was his team. He lost a man on his previous mission, and they were shorthanded. So I went over, you know, Sergeant Downey asked me if I'd run with him, and I said, yeah, I'd be glad to. So I went over, talked to him, and I said, hey, you got a mission coming up? And he goes, yeah. I said, I hear you're down a man. He goes, yeah. I guess I'll run with you. And he goes, really? I says, yeah, awesome.
Yeah.
So I said, what's the mission? Oh, they want us to go knock out a tank. And I'm going, what? I said, that tank's going to have thousands of people around.
Sure it is. Yeah.
Yeah. So so we go ahead and I flew the next day. I did an aerial recon, flew around. I took pictures and stuff. And it was all slash and burn.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where they have an agricultural thing where they cut down, after the crops, they burn it all off.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like it's like tic-tac-toe,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
It's all barren,
right?
You know? And you only place you can walk is in between those fields.
Yeah.
And you're just walking into trouble.
Yeah.
Well, the enemy's going to set up ambushes in there. They're going to run right through there.
Right. And you're not really hidden because the jungle's been cut away. Yeah, yeah.
No, it was horrible.
Yeah.
So we're flying in. We're on the first chopper. I'm with the 10. So we're coming in and we're coming down the land and all of a sudden bullets start flying all over the place.
Man.
I mean, the chopper's getting hit left and right.
Yeah.
And then, you know, we didn't hear any, none of us got hit.
Yeah.
So he said the chopper would pull up out of there and he goes, whoa. So they come over and he goes, put it into our secondary, go over to the secondary. Bullets are flying all over the place. The chopper's taking hits.
Wow.
None of us got hit.
Wow.
And so the 10 gets up and he goes, put us down over there.
Yeah.
So we try to get over this other spot, put us down, and they're getting closer, and all of a sudden the bullets start flying all over the place.
Wow.
Hitting the chopper, and all of a sudden I hear, I'm hit. So I reach over and I grab his arm and hold on to him, and the chopper gets up out of there, and then that was the end of that mission.
Yeah.
Once the team leader gets hit, that's it. You know.
Yeah.
They'll cancel that mission.
Yeah.
So we came on back. He got hit in the foot.
Oh, okay.
He had one foot on the strut, one hand on a litter pole
right.
thing, you know, to put litters in.
Yeah.
He had his hand on there and his other foot was hanging out.
Oh.
Getting ready to jump off the chopper when he got hit in the foot.
Wow.
So we were pretty close to getting on the ground and getting into some heavy dudes.
Yeah, that would have been bad news. That would have been. Did you ever see the tank?
No.
Never saw the tank.
No, we never even get the tank's got to be under a bunch of trees and hidden.
Yeah.
Well, I guess they just wanted to see how many enemy were there or something. I don't know. But I told him, I said, go in there with infrared and that thing's going to light up, you know, and you're going to see, just drop a bomb on it.
Right. What do you need us for to do that?
Exactly.
Yeah. Wow.
So.
Yeah. Crazy.
Crazy stuff.
Crazy.
So then I had another bright light where it was a team that parachuted in, and that was a piece of cake. That was a real easy bright light. We went in, we picked up Paul Boyd. Paul Boyd was on the mission and he jumped in. The team got separated and, heck, we just went on in and got him out of there. He did, you know, on a ladder, hooked on the ladder, and we just got him out.
And he was okay.
Yeah, he was fine.
Wow.
Everybody was fine.
Wow.
But the mission fell apart because they were too far apart. They were scattered.
Yeah.
And then we used to practice how to keep the teams together. I remember when I was down a long time, we said, on Infill Expo, we tried different things. So we tried these monkey strings.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you tie a rope between the three guys.
Yeah.
And then you jump out. And that way, when the chute opens up, you're all together.
Yeah.
That didn't work. The guy in the middle would come down like this.
Yeah.
The guys on the end would be at an angle like this.
Yeah.
And they're below you because they're dumping air, right?
Right.
And they'd come crashing into the ground, and we just come, the guy in the middle, I was the guy in the middle,
yeah,
came down nice and easy. So I go, how are you guys doing? Oh, man, that doesn't work.
That was fine for me. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We had another thing, too, one time with a tray, and we all sat in the tray, and the last guy would be hooked up to the aircraft, and all the other guys would be hooked up to the guy behind him.
Mm-hmm.
So then when the tray came out, the tailgate came on down, you know, it would like pop, 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 you know?
Yeah.
And that really didn't work either.
Huh. So you're always trying, always improvising, trying new things.
Yeah, we tried different kinds of things, you know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I think the best way is actually Halo.
Yeah.
And just get yourselves close together.
Yeah.
So, because if you jump out and you're far apart, you can track and get in there close to each other.
Right, right.
You can just come on down.
Yeah.
But even with Cliff Newman and Sammy Hernandez and Melvin Hill, when they made that first Halo combat jump.
Yeah.
Even those guys, I think they got separated a little bit too.
Mm-hmm.
But they jumped in at night and it was raining.
Yeah.
So it's going to be really hard to try and see where your other partner is. You know?
Yeah, that must be really tough.
Yeah. Sure. So
sure.
I volunteered for a jump mission. In fact, I tried to. I said, hey, I want to do a jump mission. He goes, oh, no, that's too dangerous. We're not going to do it. I said, come on. I want to do a jump mission. And they turned me down.
Yeah.
And then it was like 3 months later, they started doing jump missions. And I volunteered to go in with Ruff one time. Ruff was doing a jump mission. He was down at Long Ton. And I said, hey, Ruff, let me go with you.
Yeah.
Give you an extra man. He goes, well, we've been training together and these guys don't know you. I says, yeah, don't worry about that.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll talk to him. I speak Vietnamese, you know?
Yeah. 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 So, yeah.
And he goes, nah, I don't think it'll work. And man, I wish I could have gone with him. He had one guy killed on this jump mission.
Oh, wow.
The guy came down a tree and he forgot to wrap his rappel line. You know, you have a line you rappel down to get out of the trees.
Uh-huh.
And he forgot to hook it around his risers on the parachute.
Yeah.
And so when he cut away his cape wells, he just fell to the ground and he was killed.
Oh, God.
So, which is kind of sad. Those things happen. You know, they get so excited.
Members of SOG were allowed to carry whatever weapon they wanted. The weaponry Jim chose depended on the type of mission. On some, he carried an RPD, Russian light machine gun, that was sawed off to eliminate some of the weight. On others, he took a Carl Gustav M45, also known as a Swedish K, which was a fully automatic and lightweight submachine gun, and at one time standard issue for the Swedish Army. For prisoner snatches, he preferred a silenced M3 submachine gun, also known as a grease gun, which was developed in 1944 as a replacement for the Thompson submachine gun. On ambushes, he used a 12-gauge shotgun. Whenever Jim went in the field, he carried a 25-cal cathouse pistol in his pocket and a single-shot, shoulder-fired M78 grenade launcher. Don't forget to tune into part 2 of my interview with Jim Shorten, where he talks about other secret missions he led into Cambodia and Laos and his harrowing adventures in Air Force pararescue.
Heroes Behind Headlines. Executive producer Ralph Fazzullo. Produced and engineered by Mike Dawson. Music provided by Extreme Music. For exclusive content, please join our Patreon group at patreon.com/heroesbehindheadlines.